Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in American Manufacturers Mutual versus Shape.
May it please the court, Barry Chatoff will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. This is a case that's going to be packed with coverage under every personal automobile policy issued in the state of Texas. The policy was written by the state of Texas. It's on a form approved by the Texas Department of Insurance, served its authority from the legislature. It's a policy form that all the insurers use. The rates are set, taking into account what the Texas Department of Insurance says this policy means. And what they say it means is that diminution of value is not covered, and therefore the rates which are set take into account the assumption that it is not covered.
Are you telling me, or is this in the record, or can we take judicial notice of it, that there's a long line of cases saying that loss of value is covered, but today no carrier in Texas, when they pay a loss, is paying that. And so we have this big disconnect between some 30-year-old cases and between the current practice in Texas.
2 points on that. One, the long line of cases does not say that. There is a split in the old cases. And to the extent the old cases go that way, are argued to go that way, a careful examination shows that they are either wrong in that they apply tort values, tort issues, methods of analysis, as opposed to contract analysis, or they, although they have dicta about value, they are not talking about a loss in value. They are cases where the automobile was a total loss, and therefore the value concept comes in.
But today in Texas, insurers are following the Department of Insurance standard.
Yes, as is in the record, there are two bulletins which speak to this. One is the TDI bulletin saying diminution of value is not covered. The other is the mirror, as reflected in the Lewis opinion from the Austin court, that is that betterment, the insurers don't get the advantage of betterment. They don't have to pay diminution of value.
Now, the argument has been made that, as I understand, that a majority of other jurisdictions looking at this language conclude that diminution of value is included. Is that correct, or is it this?
2 points on that. We have a disagreement as to how they should be counted. But when one looks at those opinions and looks at the recent opinion, it is clear that the recent trend is to not include diminution of value. And the courts that specifically are looking at it include Supreme Courts of several states which have followed the Carlton decision, adopted the same reasoning as Carlton, and have cited Carlton as being correct. That is, interpreting the policy based upon the language of the policy and rejecting these concepts of the old. In each of those cases, in fact, where the Supreme Courts of Delaware, Maine, and Florida have looked at it, they have had old cases, as Texas has old cases, which go the other way. Those Supreme Courts rejected that and went with the Carlton view that you interpret the policy. Now, there are a number of cases in Texas which go the other way, old cases. 1927, the case that goes one way, 1927, the case that goes the other. And those cases that go against us simply insert the words value without reference to any precedent, prior cases, and...
That's not true, and Dallas court doesn't do that. And Dallas court gave a pretty good analysis of it in Bailey, wasn't it?
Well, in Bailey, with respect, they looked at the value issue. They inserted value, and they did a tort analysis.
They did with value, and I guess they're, what are they looking at, the word quality? Is that what they're... I'm sorry, go ahead.
They looked at the word quality and assumed that it meant value. A couple points on that. Those other states I talked about and the other recent trend in cases who look at it do not insert it. Of course, they are just the opposite view that the Houston court had. But secondly, when one inserts that that value in there, then there is no way to reconcile the clear limitations of liability provision and the payment of loss provision, which says that the insurer may pay for loss in money or may repair the car.
Well, let's just look at the words. It says, I think, same kind and quality. Doesn't
it? It actually says...
Like kind and quality. Would you think that those two words mean the same thing?
Those two words being quality and value?
Uh-huh.
Well, if one
looks... No. Kind and quality. Do you read those as meaning the same thing?
Not necessarily.
All right. How would you distinguish them?
There are instances. One of the things that we have to remember is that this provision of the policy covers more than just a wrecked automobile. It can cover, for example, a stolen stereo from an automobile. And what the carrier is given the option of doing is to repair or, in that case, to replace the property with other of like kind, if it was a Bose stereo, and quality, of the same quality as the Bose stereo which was stolen.
Okay, and so... Don't you think, though, the legislature meant by kind and quality, they meant a distinction by using those two words? You don't read them synonymously, do you?
Actually, we know exactly what the legislature meant, because the way the legislature wrote those words was to tell the TDI to write whatever words they were thought were appropriate, and TDI has told us what they meant, and what they meant is that diminution of value is not covered. And then like kind and quality does not include value.
Just to follow up on that point, what deference does this court have to give or should we give to the TDI rule?
Well, the court traditionally has looked to administrative agencies to interpret their own rules and regulations. It makes sense that this court would look also to a administrative agency which writes a contract to interpret.
Do we need to do that if the policy itself is, as you contend, unambiguous? Does it matter what they say?
Interesting conundrum for someone on my side of this issue, because I certainly don't want to argue that it's ambiguous, because then we fall into the issue of whether, if you have an insurance policy that's ambiguous, then you defer to the insured, but only to the insured if this other interpretation is reasonable. I think that by seeing what the TDI says, and this court has said that in essence the TDI is stating what the intent of the parties is, that to give an interpretation which is contrary to the intent of the parties is not a reasonable interpretation.
Let me ask you on kind of a bigger picture. Is it the insurance company's option whether to pay the market value or to repair?
Yes.
So, assuming that you are correct, that the choice to repair does not require indemnification for the loss of value, does that necessarily undervalue the repair for the purposes of determining whether the accident's a total loss? So I'm looking at this car, and I'm having to determine if it's a total loss, and I've you know, my lay understanding would be that it would cost more the repair than the value of the car. But if the insurance company does not have to consider the market value of the car after the repair, it would seem to me there's a disconnect in this determination. So if you may determine that the car is not totaled because once you repair it, you don't also have to be responsible for the diminution of value. Now, how does that work? Tell me what the insurer's view is in evaluating whether this is a total loss or a repairable loss when the insurer does not have to consider the aftermarket value of the car when it's repaired.
The option of the insurer, the cap that is put on the insurer's liability, is the limit of what it's going to take to bring the car back to where it is at its pre-accident function and appearance. If it can be brought back to its pre-accident function and appearance, then it has been repaired, as that word is interpreted by court after court, and if you look in the dictionary, that's what it means. And so if it's repaired, thus ends the insurer's obligation, even though this, there has been a psychological market value diminution in value.
Is it fair to say that most insurers wouldn't care one way or the other whether this was covered or not, as long as everybody knows going in it is and the premium placed on that?
No. And here's why. It brings more problems than just needing to adjust the rates. It does a couple of things. First of all, it means that in every case where there's an accident, you have to assess the psychological loss to the car's market value. And so the cost of investigation goes way up. Secondly, you're opening the door to a lot of litigation when the insurance company determines that we've got $300 of loss of value because it's been decided we have to cover that, and the insurer says, no, it's $500. If you look at what the TDI is thinking, it's saying, we're not going to make the insurers write a contract that puts them in that position. TDI knows it could cover it, but has chosen not to do so.
In the other states, there's a lot of listing of cases here by both sides and assertions of overwhelming majorities in both briefs. But is there some, in the respondent's brief, there's an assertion that the insurance services office has recommended clarifying this to say, we don't cover this. And that has been, quote, received approval from at least 29 states. Is there any counting of states as to, after all the smoke clears and the court decisions are over with and the agencies have come back in and the policies have been rewritten, how many states cover diminished value and how many don't?
By our count, and I've talked to counsel and discussed how each of us counts, it is far more which do not cover it. And this ISO, first of all, the case is clear that merely clarifying something which is a contract which already goes in a direction doesn't mean a concession that it doesn't go your way. But secondly, the state after state, the Supreme Courts and the appellate courts are saying no on this, the modern decisions.
But even if the court said, yes, we think it's covered under this language, have states come back in after that and said, well, no, we want to clarify that it's not covered? Has that happened?
The only recent state of which I'm aware that the Supreme Court has gone the other direction is Georgia. I do not know if in Georgia they have modified the policy.
The last time I bought a car, the dealer whisked out a form that showed that it had been in a wreck some years earlier, which shows the kind of car I buy, and that it had been, you know, totally repaired, and said he was required by law to disclose that, which didn't happen the time before last I bought a car. So either it wasn't in a wreck or this is a new law. But I assume he wasn't doing that out of the goodness of his heart. It was a law, and so when you're in a wreck and you ever want to sell that car, you're going to have to fill this paperwork out, and that at least the purchaser is going to try to offer you less money because of that.
Correct. That is certainly possible that their courts have looked at that and said, yes, that's correct. But the issue we have is whether that loss is covered by the contract. Or another way of looking at it, has the contract capped the liability so that loss isn't covered? One example of a loss, a cap on the amount owed, is on a declaration page. A homeowner's policy, there are many policies, where it says we'll pay no more than $100,000. There may be a lot of things that are covered in the word loss, but you've capped your liability. One of the ways that the state of Texas has capped liability for these losses, including diminution in value, is saying that you can either repair it or pay money, that the limited liability is a lesser of two things. Our liability is therefore capped. It is the way they figure the rates. It is the way, in their administrative capacity, deciding what the best approach is to the relationship between insured and insurers, the state of Texas has decided that diminution value should not be covered.
Mr. Sasnoff, what we're dealing with here is a matter of contract interpretation, correct?
Yes,
not writing on a blank slate or setting policy, although there are policy implications of the decision that we're going to make, correct?
Yes, sir.
Let's assume then the Chief Justice buys a car and the market value is $10,000. Let's assume I buy the same car, and at the time I buy it, the market value is $10,000. Chief totals his car, he gets a check for $10,000 from his insurer. I wreck my car, gets repaired, and have to repair to worth $9,000. Respond to the argument that that shouldn't be the way that this contract is applied.
That is an argument that it's not fair that the state of Texas has decided that the insurance policy you bought would not cover that loss in value. And the fact is, as a consumer, what you've done by being a little bit better driver than the Chief Justice and not totaling your car.
I think we can take judicial notice of that.
is that you are in a position where the contract you bought, in that contract, you did not pay to have that $1,000 covered. Theoretically, one could try to find supplemental insurance or something else if one wanted to cover that, but that is simply not the contract you entered with the insurer to cover you in that instance.
In those states where there's no coverage, is there coverage available for diminution?
I do not know the answer to that.
Let me ask you this, just conceptually, the difference between the tort measure and the contract measure here. If a driver hits a tree, that's a first-party claim, and your argument is there's no value increment to that payment. But if the driver gets hit by an underinsured or uninsured driver, then the driver would get value. And I don't understand the reason for that.
It's a difference in the sections of the policy.
No, I understand that, but just conceptually, why should that be any different?
Because in the underinsured motors section, what the policy and the state have agreed that should happen is that you will be covered as for the liability that person would have to you in tort if that person had the money to pay you. And the insurance company is stepping into the feet and in the shoes of the other uninsured motorist, and he or she would owe you the tort value, that is, what they did to you. But in Section D, we have a different contract provision, and Section D says there's a limit of liability, and we have options on which loss we pay, repair or replace.
Mr. Chastoff, I want to follow up because I didn't quite finish. If the word quality means value, then diminished value is covered under this contract. Is that right?
If the word quality means value. I don't think so, because we also have the payment of loss section, which allows us to either pay in money or repair the vehicle, and our obligation is paid.
I'm talking about this one phrase. That's the only phrase in issue here, isn't it?
Oh, I think the entire contract has to be read as a whole.
Well, sure, the whole contract's an issue, but that's basically the issue that's being argued about diminished value.
It is where Schaefer has chosen to focus to not look at all the other words that surround it, but I think that if all the words are looked at that surround it and the entire policy, that it does not decide the issue.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Vincent. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Ryan will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I think you hit it right on the head. Direct and accidental loss in the scenarios that the courts have already given us includes diminished value. Nobody disputes it. Part A, you recovered a third party, as you talked about, Justice O'Neill, in the tort issue. Part D is what's at issue here, but under Part C, the policy, uninsured motorist provision, which is contractual, they acknowledge diminished value as a loss. There is no dispute before this court that diminished value is a loss under an insurance policy. The only point they make here
is that the limitation of liability, the words repair and replace of like kind and quality,
well, it's
means something.
Here's something
different.
That confuses me.
Okay.
It's repair or replace.
Right.
So
repair and replace.
When I read subsection 2, I'm really want to put a comma after repair. We seem to be saying those are synonymous, but it seems to me they can either, one, pay actual cash value, two, amount to repair, or three, they can replace it. And the clause before it says the lesser of. So why isn't amount necessary to repair just, why doesn't that stand alone? Because it is an or.
Well, but they're talking about what the cost of repair is and trying to separate it from the issue of returning the vehicle to the same value that it was pre-accident.
But I've got her same question. Mm-hmm. It does say the lesser of actual cash value,
sure,
or. And it seems to me that recognizes that inherently sometimes the cash value may be more than or less than the amount necessary to repair.
Absolutely.
So they have their choice. So sometimes they repair it, it's going to be worth more than the cash value. Sometimes they repair it, it's going to be less, but that's the insurance company's choice.
Absolutely correct. But you're talking about the actual cash value of the vehicle pre-accident. What we're talking about is the cost of repair plus post-repair value.
No, but I'm saying the policy seems to recognize that the value of the automobile pre-crash could be more than the value of the automobile after repair. Lesser seems to recognize that and gives the insurance company the option under the express language.
Absolutely. No one's saying that they cannot exercise that option.
Then where's the obligation to then pay on top of that?
Well, the obligation, you start first with the fact that loss includes diminished value. Nobody disputes that. Then you go to the issue of limitation of liability. And then you get into the question, is the contract limitation unambiguous such that you can say, absolutely, it's excluded diminished value? At best, because of the terms of the policy, such as Justice Snyder referenced, quality and kind, they are two different terms. Kind talks about function, and quality talks about value. That is not the distinction that Schaefer makes. That's the distinction that many courts that have looked at this issue make.
But if you did a hard return and made number three replace the property with other of like kind and quality, and so you just had amount necessary to repair standing alone, wouldn't the clear language just say amount necessary to repair?
Well,
I mean, we seem to be importing the like kind and quality into the repair piece.
But it's all part of the same language. I mean, it includes that provision of like kind and quality. And it's not just limited to the value or just the amount of repair. The policy was not that clear. And so what, in fact, is being argued by the insurance company is, we will say it is clear to us based on a TDI bulletin that doesn't have any import in this setting.
Well, but I guess what I'm saying is, even if you say like, kind, and quality is synonymous with value, even if we say that's true, there's still an or between repair and or replace with like, kind, and quality. So it seems like the latter piece of two incorporates value, but the first part does not.
Well, I beg to differ. You got to read the whole sentence together. I don't think you can truncate it and just only reference repair and say that just means the amount of repair. I think the whole sentence has meaning in the context of the case law in Texas, which said you must consider the actual returning the car to substantially the same value it was pre-accident.
Can the insurance, let's assume that under that policy, you're correct, that diminished value is also included in the cost of repair and replacement, like kind of quality. Can an insurance company ever, how does it assess this difference to determine whether the case, the car is a total loss or should be repaired? How do they make that determination if, in evaluating the cost of repair, they've got to include this diminished value.
The truth is, they already do it. When appraisers go out and look at a car and inspect a car, they make an estimate of not only the cost of repair, but value of this car in the marketplace, because there are markets out there for damaged and repair automobiles that they, in fact, index and are able to determine valuation. I mean, that's the reality, is that they are able to determine based on resale of cars, both through auction results, both through general secondary markets, both through used car markets, what the value of automobiles are based on severity of damage, based on the mileage of the automobile, based on all the particulars of that car. That's what appraisers do every day. You know, what is Justice Phillips mentioned this point, there seems to be a disconnect between the case law and what's happening out in the real world. Let me tell you, out in the real world, before Carlton, they paid diminished value. They paid it in a third-party case. They paid it in an uninsured motorist case.
Do we have that in the record?
I don't know that it's actually in your record.
I don't want to be confused.
Okay.
I mean, if there's some...
Insurance
commissioner keeps these statistics somewhere, that would be very helpful if we knew that.
Yeah. I mean, it's
having
it's
been a much worse daughter than Chief Justice Phillips and having been paid many times in the first party, I was never paid that.
Well, here's most people don't know it exists, but if you go to court and hire an appraiser and litigate the issue of diminished value, they'll settle and they'll pay it. That's because they pay it under the third party, and they pay it under uninsured motors, which is a contractual undertaking. This distinction between tort and contract is an illusion.
Does the insurance commissioner's bulletin indicate that that's the basis for the premiums that they calculate? That's argued here.
Well, that's argued here, but the truth of the matter is that bulletin, for many reasons, doesn't apply in a contract construction case, which is what we have here. The policy is to favor the insured, number one.
No, I'm just asking, is that what the insurance commissioner thought when he was writing the policy and setting the premiums?
I don't know, to be totally frank with the court. I can tell you this, though. The TDI, according to your precedent, Belladron and National Union, says it applies in statutory construction cases. Doesn't apply in a contract construction case, that the TDI bulletin shouldn't have any weight unless it's been submitted to public comment. There's no evidence that that has been done in this case. And third, it is unreasonable on its face. There is no distinction as to why they pay Part A and pay Part C and for some reason mysteriously don't think they owe it on Part D.
Well, the troublesome thing, particularly here, lots of times you wonder, as a court, how much deference to give an agency.
True.
Because of how much leeway they have to set policy. But if the department actually had a hand in writing this policy, then it seems to me it's sort of indicative of what they thought it meant.
Plus when they said the right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they write the policy to the extent they write all insurance policies in the state of Texas. You obviously, as you well know, don't get insurance policy in the state without the regulatory authority approving it. But let's not create another fiction that is now being written by the state of Texas. We all know it's written by the insurance company.
Well, I don't understand where all this argument comes in, because to me, you don't look at what TDI does unless you find it's ambiguous, and if it's ambiguous,
absolutely,
you go for the insured. So it's hard for me to see that it's a relevant inquiry.
You're absolutely correct. And in Carlton, that's what the court said. Carlton is the decision they hang their hat on. But in Carlton, the 14th court said, we're not going to decide that the TDI has any relevance because we think it's unambiguous, of course, in the insurance company's favor. If it's ambiguous, maybe they have an argument that comes in, but even then the case law says no, it doesn't come in a contract construction case anyway.
Well, let me ask you, on
it's
your question about they pay it under the third-party coverage and they pay it under the uninsured motorist coverage, but don't they assess premiums for each of those categories?
True.
And they set a different premium for the collision.
I don't know. I understand your point, but I don't know, and I don't think anyone here in this record has developed on what basis those premiums are established.
But the fact that those are separate insuring agreements
doesn't that support their position that just because a loss is covered one way under this under one part, it doesn't necessarily mean it's covered the second under a second part? Because don't they treat those as separate insuring obligations?
Yeah, I understand your point, and it's a good point. If we knew that, in fact, policies are set and rates are established based on different losses and their understanding what that loss will be, there's no evidence before us. That would be an assumption to support an argument. See, this case is going to turn very easily. I don't want to say easily. Nothing's been easy about this litigation. But simply on an issue of contract construction.
Why is the what is the basis of the difficulty of counting what the other states do?
Okay. I looked at this issue because I knew it would come up, and I even did an analysis based on electoral votes, you know, who had more states, but population, electoral vote. The fact of the matter is, if you want to do it by what other jurisdictions do, we probably win that battle. But I was just visiting with the counsel for petitioner before the argument. I said, you know, if you want to argue the other jurisdiction argument, you're probably fair by just saying it's evenly split. Now, your point earlier, which was a good one about policy exclusion, what's going on out there in the real world? Well, I know because in Minnesota, for example, the Supreme Court of Minnesota has recognized diminished value. And so some insurance companies, some, have adopted a policy exclusion. You see, what most places...
Some have adopted policy excluding coverage of this.
That's correct, diminished value. Because that, of course, goes through the regulatory process, has to be approved by the state commissioner.
So do we know, this seems to me to be to go to the issue of, is this something as a state or a regulatory body or a legislature, whoever, do we want this to be covered? I mean, just make that choice. And at the end of the day, after you count up all the decisions mm-hmm. and you see what insurers have come in behind and done, is there any sense of how many states actually cover this and how many don't?
Yeah, about 14 in favor and somewhere 6 to 8 looks like don't. That's where it's been decided. Not every state, of course, has a Supreme Court opinion on this issue.
Well, but when you say it was the ISO language was, quote, approved in 29 states, what does that mean?
That refers to the policy exclusion language that an insurance company can adopt if it wants to. See, ISO drafts language right. of exclusion for insurance companies and proffers that out there as a trade association. That diminished value has become a big issue, obviously, for auto insurers around
so
the country.
So 29 states say, if you don't want to cover this, you don't have to.
No, they say, here's the language of exclusion you can use. And in some states, people have used the exclusion.
And is
the
it
language
29?
Yes.
So it's 29.
Yeah, there's 29 states. I'm not saying that in each of those states that DD is excluded. I'm simply saying that the language of exclusion has been adopted or approved by the commissioners of insurance for use in the state if an insurance company elects to do so. And that language for exclusion has been approved as opposed to 29 states excluded by language of contract. That's the distinction there. Now, I don't see it as a policy decision. I see it as a contract issue. The policy decision is you've got states that go for it and some that don't. You get
well,
down.
I'm saying is if the insurance commission said you have to write this policy and you can't write anything else, that would be a policy decision.
Well, that's absolutely clear, but that's not where it's headed. What happens in different jurisdictions, for example, in Georgia, Supreme Court of Georgia decided diminished value is covered. The Commissioner of Insurance then issues a bulletin that told all insurance carriers in the state of Georgia that have these policies that they must include diminished value. It is then incumbent on an insurance company, because it doesn't want to do business in that state, issuing that kind of policy, to say we want to adopt an exclusion and to ask that the commissioner approve that, much like we see ongoing in the state of Texas with mold currently. Just some companies do not want to have a policy that covers mold, and therefore there's a great deal of time and effort put into language of exclusion to make sure it's not covered. So it's that type of process.
But even if you were going to cover it, you'd want the premium to reflect that.
Well, that's true. And whether there's nothing in this record for us to know that if you, in this case, recognize as a contract issue that they have a duty of diminished value, can you say, well, we're raising the premiums of insurers around Texas, and we're changing policy? That's not how this would be determined, or should not be determined. It's not a policy issue in that sense.
Well, but it seems to me, if you're paying, I mean, the diminished value hypotheticals in the briefs are substantial. I mean,
sure.
Like 50, 60, 80, 100% of the rest of the claim.
Right.
And so if the claims paid were going to go up that much, mm-hmm. it looks to me like there would have to be a reflection of the premiums.
No doubt that it is going to affect how they both adjust it, and no doubt that it will involve some additional or potential adjustment of claims. I mean, I think that's common sense. But
it would go up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, you're back to elections, as Justice Oden was pointing out, and Justice O'Neill, you do have an election as the insurance company created a total loss, actual cash value of the vehicle, and or the value of repair plus post-repair value inclusion. So
let me ask you a question. Is using the mold as an example,
yes.
The Department of Insurance says these policies include mold. The policy comes up for renewal, and you get notified by your insurance company that we're renewing your policy, but you can exclude mold coverage. If you exclude mold coverage, this is your premium, but if you continue with mold coverage, your premium is four times as high.
Right.
So as a practical matter, everybody's going to exclude the mold, unless you're absolutely wealthy and you don't care what the price of your insurance is. So everybody excludes mold. Well, the transaction cost of rewriting all those policies, making those decisions, pretty significant, although it's hard to put an answer to. Should this court be concerned about those 29 states that now permit insurance companies to exclude that in terms of the transaction cost and when it decides what its policy will be here? We look at this policy, it's not really clear, but kind of we think probably it ought to be excluded. Is it proper for us to consider that's probably what the outcome will be of this case? No matter how we decide it, ultimately all the insurance policies will be written to exclude this unless there's an increase in premium. Should we be concerned about that in deciding the outcome of this case, that we know ultimately how it's going to come out anyway?
No, I don't think it's a matter of setting policy. The flip side of that coin is that the consumer, everyone who owns an automobile, is obviously entitled to the return of that vehicle after an accident to the value that it was in substantially before the accident. I mean, that's what the law has been in this state. So to take the one-sided approach that, well, you know, rates might be reflected and may go up, it seems to me the consumer has a side to this equation. The consumer has a right to get that coverage or elect not to get that coverage because they think they want that to be, that part of it to be covered when they're in an accident.
But if he wanted the coverage, he'd have to pay more.
That may be, absolutely. I mean, we know there's no free lunches. We obviously know that if they think it's not covered now, that they're going to have some additional premium. Our rates are raising. You get in a car accident, it has nothing to do with diminished value. Your rates are going to go up.
But Mr. O'Brien, the counter argument to what they're saying is that isn't there an expectation on the part of the secured creditor that the value of the collaterals not diminish?
Absolutely, and that's footnoted as part of the...
And further, you said that this is a construction issue. Are you contending that this is ambiguous?
No, I'm contending it's unambiguous, that the whole body of Texas law has supported that the issue of value is an integral part of repair of a vehicle. Absolutely unambiguous. But it is strange for us to see that a 14th Court of Appeals thinks it's unambiguous the other way. So push come to shove, if it's ambiguous, all the construction is in our favor. But make no mistake about it, we believe that the issue of kind and quality includes both function, physical characteristics of the vehicle, returning it to its pre-accident condition, and value, that there is no metaphysical disconnect between a physical repair of a car and its value. We live in a world of a value. You don't sell a car based on cost.
Mr. O'Brien,
you set it on value.
Let's go back to my example.
Yes.
The Chief's car worth $10,000, my car worth $10,000, his car gets totaled, he gets a check for $10,000, I wreck mine, it gets repaired, after the repair is only worth $9,000. In the real world, how would you see me getting back to the $10,000 value for my car so I'd be in a similar situation with the chief? Do I get a check for $1,000 on top of the repair? Do you add some options to the car? What do you do in that situation?
You would get the cost of repair plus the diminution in the market value of your car post-repair. So if the appraisal is that your vehicle now after repair is $9,000 and you've essentially lost $1,000 of value based on an appraisal, and you get both cost of repair plus value, then the insurance company can make some election.
And what does the secured creditor have to say about that $1,000?
Well, the secured creditor is going to be happy that the value of his collateral is protected, which is Judge Schneider's point. Isn't there a reasonable expectation?
Well, the $1,000 check was written to me, as I understand it, not to the secured creditor.
Not if they got a lien on the vehicle. I mean, we know what happens when they've got a lien on a secured creditor on a vehicle and you get a cost of repair check even. You don't get that cost of repair a check, that vehicle is repaired. If there's any additional amount, that is an issue that the bank is very certain to be concerned about, in fact, it's collateral.
That leads you then to a jury trial in every case as to what the diminished value is.
And that's what the law has been. That is what the law has been in Texas. And that's what's been going out in the real world, is that the issue of how much diminution in value occurs in any given factual situation is a function of the circumstance of that case, the age of the car, the severity of it. Now, does it necessarily result in a trial in each case? No, any more than any dispute under an insurance policy, third-party contract case necessarily results in a trial. Because there are formulas based on severity, based on market values of cars sold every day in America. There are millions of cars sold from which data can be arrived to determine diminution in value for cars based on style, based on model, based on color, based on all of characteristics.
What is the evidence on the psychological impact of an accident? What kind of evidence? In a trial, what would the evidence be? You're saying it would be style of the car? Or what?
Yeah, what you're talking about here are all the characteristics that go into market value. That is the province of experts like appraisers. Okay, and we're not talking about a person getting up and talking in terms of, well, I don't think I can sell my car for as much as I could because it was in an accident, because it's got something on there about a repair. We're talking about expert testimony of appraisers who come in every day. This is done every day in both third-party cases as well as uninsured motorist cases. Appraisers come in from the insurance company. They give a number, and the consumer gives a number. It's usually negotiated and or litigated just like every other.
I'm just curious, how do you quantify what the psychological impact is in the market of a car that's been in an accident? What would it look like?
Because there's data out there every day. Cars are sold at auction every day that have been damaged, and they have marks for severity of damage. Is it structural? Is it cosmetic? Is the car red? Is it blue? Is it a Model X? Is it a Model Y? I mean, there are a whole variety of characteristics that go into an appraiser's valuation of any car at any given point of time, be it pre-accident, post-accident. This is well known to appraisers in the field, and I can tell you day in and day out because I've dealt with these people. That's how they do it. They go to the auctions. You talk to any car dealer. Just walk up to any car dealer and talk to them about a value of any kind of vehicle. With repairs, the value of repairs, how much they were, and how much he thinks that car will sell in the marketplace, and they'll be able to tell you with a reasonable approximation what that answer will be.
Any other questions?
Mr. Yes, one more. Yep. Mr. O'Brien, you would you please answer what I guess is an implication in the petitioner's briefs that this sudden interest in this particular clause, because as I understand it, there was a vacant period there with really no litigation in it, is because plaintiff lawyers have discovered that they can, by class action,
are taking advantage of that. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think he raises a valid point. I mean, the truth is the reason this has bubbled to the surface in many places is because lawyers have tried to present these cases as class actions. I personally don't find that offensive, that consumers of various states are being represented by lawyers in a class action context. But that's a different issue. Is DV certifiable as a class? That's another day. I mean, there may be some that say predominance is too much of an issue in a class case, and you couldn't do it that way. You might have to do it, as Justice O'Neill said, individual cases, just like we do auto accident cases. But that's not the issue here today. The issue here today is a single case of Mr. Schaefer and the contract construction, where the thin reed that the courts have held that this not to cover DV is because that Webster's Dictionary, when it talks about repair and replacement, means good or usable condition. Well, I say Webster could have easily mean, when it says good and usable condition, a vehicle that has its true market value. Not less than its market value, but its true value, as Judge Enoch recognized in Underwood. Now, they might say that's a third-party case, but clearly it seems to me in that decision, Judge Enoch, writing for the Chief Justice of the Dallas Court, talked about value of a car. This is class action. I personally don't find that offensive, that consumers of various states are being represented by lawyers in a class action context. But that's a different issue. Is DV certifiable as a class? That's another day. I mean, there may be some that say predominance is too much of an issue in a class case, and you couldn't do it that way. You might have to do it, as Justice O'Neill said, individual cases, just like we do auto accident cases. But that's not the issue here today. The issue here today is a single case of Mr. Schaefer and the contract construction, where the thin reed that the courts have held that this not to cover DV is because that Webster's Dictionary, when it talks about repair and replacement, means good or usable condition. Well, I say Webster could have easily mean, when it says good and usable condition, a vehicle that has its true market value. Not less than its market value, but its true value, as Judge Enoch recognized in Underwood. Now, they might say that's a third-party case, but clearly it seems to me in that decision, Judge Enoch, writing for the Chief Justice of the Dallas Court, talked about value of a car, the value before and after. I thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. A few points. One, I don't want there to be a misimpression that the body of law in Texas, that every case leading up to the recent cases has gone, that there is coverage for diminished value. The first case going the other way, I said, was in 1927. In 1927, same year, in the Radford case, the Dallas court said that you have to turn it to the substantially as good condition without putting the value term in. And then, as we cite in our brief, there are a series of cases that go the other direction. So the authority is split in Texas, and this court has never looked at the issue. Two, there was a comment about the transaction cost of this change. One of the costs of going the other way is the class action issue. There are 15 to 18 pending. There are a number of, I think, four or five up for review on this same issue before this court. If the policy, in essence, if the court goes with Schaefer, then that opens the door on those plans of actions or a bunch of individual actions. Third point, secured creditors. Secured creditors are not parties to this contract. They may be a beneficiary of it, but they are not a party. If they desire more coverage than they find under their insurance policy, then they can certainly insure themselves.
Well, nor are the rest of the people of Texas as far as policyholders. But we were looking at it from a policy standpoint of why you would is there a societal policy for
continuing or paying diminished value or not paying.
And what I'm saying is that if the secured creditor community feels that these policies do not adequately cover them, then they can separately acquire coverage, and this coverage I do know is available, to cover them for their potential additional loss for any transactions they do.
How do you account for the sudden interest in this clause? Was the industry paying these clause? Were they paying diminished values in individual cases?
In some cases, it was paid. I think the implication was, and I think it's correct, sometimes to settle a lawsuit, insurance companies would settle the lawsuit by paying it rather than going to court over a $300 or $1,000 difference. As a policy matter, they were not in general, especially in light of what the TDI has been telling them. So it has not in general been paid. Another point. There was a question about the Bailey decision and also then a reference to Underwood. Bailey in Dallas simply relied on Underwood, which was a case really misinterpreted by the Bailey Court. In Underwood, there was a theft of a car. It sat in a lake for 3 days to a week. There was a dispute about that, and the jury finding in essence was that you could not repair this car after it sits in a lake. The other difficulty with that case is, as you see in Justice Enoch's discussion of it, is that when the insurance company argued that case, the insurance company argued in terms of we returned it to its previous value. And so the issue was never presented as to whether they had an obligation to return it to the previous value. They simply, in that case, chose to argue it that way and argued that they had, but the specific finding was that it had, it could not be repaired, that it was a total loss, and therefore the value had to be paid.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes today's arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. The Honorable.